Good morning, 741 here on the Mighty 690, and it is time for our update from the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. Joining us, we have Wendy Powell and James Coover in studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good to have you here. So, Wendy, I know you're saying you've got some events that you'd like to tell us about.
Yeah, next Tuesday, we've got a pond meeting, kind of a workshop where you can go around and see some interesting things with ponds. Dave and Sarance is putting that meeting on. It is going to be Tuesday the 26th in the evening. And then on the 28th, there is going to be a big stalker field day in Manhattan. So anybody interested in the stalker industry, lots of industry updates, just tons of information that they'll go through with that. And then November 10th, I know that's a ways away, there's going to be a swine field day in Manhattan. So lots of information on the swine industry for that meeting.
Excellent. And James, did you have any events that are coming up that you want to have us be thinking about right now?
Nope. Wendy covered them.
But, good deal.
Know, don't forget about the pond workshop. It's actually going to be at my house. And so we're going to look at some cool stuff. So.
Good deal. See how your pond shapes up against the Coover pond.
Yeah. My pond is especially not good looking. So that's why we're looking at it. So we can see what it's not supposed to look like.
Wendy needs help on that. Good deal. All right. Well, Wendy, I know you want to talk just a little bit about some weeds in pastures today.
Yes. So I've had a pretty common question come across my desk. Ragweed and broomweed and sericea, this is the time of the year that we're really seeing those bush out. They just look so big in the pastures and really just a nuisance, all three of them. One, sericea is way more of a nuisance than the other two. So if you are seeing sericea in your pasture, typically now would be the time to be controlling that. We would be seeing it bloom in certain parts of our area. We are seeing it bloom, and you certainly can spray that when it's in bloom with some Metsulfuron active ingredient product like Escort. But if you're not seeing that bloom, it's because of the drought. It's just too dry for that plant to bloom. It doesn't have enough water to fulfill its usual needs. So there's no point in spraying it. Just don't waste your time and your money on herbicide, because you spray that herbicide on the leaf and it's not going to make it way down to the roots. So that's not going to be a beneficial use of your time and resources. Ragweed and broomweed are a couple of other big bushy plants that we see out there. These are a little bit easier to control, especially earlier in the year. Right now, there's not much you can do with them, so a lot of folks are going to be brush hogging pastures just to get some sunshine down to the soil. I stress caution with brush hogging pastures, simply because if there's no grass underneath these big weeds, then we're going to expose that soil to some wind erosion, hopefully some rain erosion if we ever get enough rain for erosion to be a problem again. So just use caution if you're going to be brush hogging. Raise the cutter bar as high as you can. Maybe don't brush hog too close to a rain event in the forecast. Just use caution. And if you want to talk through your specific situation, I'm happy to do that. Just give me a call.
Now, Wendy, I've noticed that in some places where, you know, you may have disturbed soil, you have different weeds that grow in it for whatever reason. And I don't know, like, if there's a reason for why that is, but I just always think that's interesting where, that seems to happen.
Yeah. So that is pretty typical. Like if terraces have been taken out of a pasture, you'll see strips of different types of plants come in. And that's simply because the other seeds that are in the soil have been exposed. So our soil contains tons and tons of seeds, and some of them will last longer than others. And whenever they get exposed, they can just take hold and they emerge and sometimes become a problem, sometimes not. James might have some more information on that too.
Yeah, and so if it's something like, you know, spiny amaranth, for instance, it always occurs around the hay bunk. And so it's very well at taking off in very high nutrient situations. It can really explode in size. And so really there are just very small ecological niches that these various weeds retain. And also just because that's the seed that's present. And so, I mean, if seed that has lots of that, you know, buttercup weed, for instance, or fields that are going to have a lot of more buttercup. So,
mm-hmm. Sure. It's not all as homogenous as we sometimes like.
Absolutely not.
Nature doesn't really like that. No. So, well, you know, I know there's some various tools as well that can help people to manage some of these weeds and pastures, kind of figuring out, you know, what your pasture is made of, what the soil is, all mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
Yes. So one of the things that I really wanted to talk about today was sampling techniques and how we can kind of take some steps now and using our resources more timely. If you get some soil sampling done, fertilize, you know, proper grazing numbers. And this way we can kind of drought proof our pastures. So I have talked to several people about how some of their fescue or Bermuda or whatever has survived the drought and it's been okay. It might be a little bit stressed, but it's not gone. And that's because those pastures have not been over consumed or they've been properly fertilized, things like that. So starting now with our cool season pastures, if we can get those soil sampled, apply some fertilizer, then those pastures are going to be way better off. Even though it takes quite a bit of money to get that done, at the end of the day, or at the end of a decade even, we are a lot better off. So I wanted to visit a little bit about how we collect a soil sample.
Yes, so soil samples, you're saying, are not just for the garden. They can be for pastures.
Absolutely, yes. So each of our offices have soil probes that folks can borrow, and they just need to come in and ask for a probe. And if they're not already checked out to another producer, then you're welcome to borrow those. And so what you'll do whenever you have a pasture, it gets kind of complicated because pastures are not homogeneous, just like we already talked about. So let's think of a pasture that maybe has a creek running through it. And so the gate side of the pasture to the creek that has been maybe put up for hay a couple of times in a time of you need extra hay for the winter, and you've also run livestock on there, so therefore it's a different management site than what might be behind the creek where you maybe can't access it with a tractor or equipment that's never been hayed. So you'll want to sample those differently. They're two different management units. One sample is going to represent maybe 20 to 30 acres. You don't want to go more than that because the soils are just going to be that much more different. And you want a good representative sample. The results of a soil sample analysis are only as good as the sampling that has been done in the pasture. So it's super important that we don't take samples like out of a low spot or through a cow paddy or something that's not going to be representative of the whole place. So whenever you borrow a soil probe, you're going to be pulling cores, what we call cores. You're going to go 4 to 6 inches down as deep as possible. Right now, that's laughable because it's so dry. But as well as you can, or you might need to wait for a rain event or something like that. So do the best you can with that. You're going to pull 8 to 10 cores per 20 to 30 acres. And you're going to put those into a bucket and mix it all together really well. And that is what creates one sample. So you've got several sub-samples across this acreage, and that creates one sample. And that's what you bring into the office. It's about 2 cups of soil, and then we send that to the lab, and the lab tests it for all kinds of things, phosphorus, potassium, pH. We can do some other numbers on that, but those are the main ones we worry about with pasture. And then I look at those numbers, and I can give you some recommendations on how much fertilizer to apply, what time of year to apply that, depends on what forage you're trying to grow. And I have worked with several producers trying to grow mixed pastures, you know, fescue and clover. And so we can navigate through those protocols too. So it's one of those, it is kind of labor intensive to collect that soil. But once you have those numbers, then you have a much better picture of what your pasture is like.
Well, and two, I would think that maybe having some of that information, if you ever do look into selling some property, you know, having that profile and that information could be very valuable for the buyer.
Absolutely, yes. A lot of times buyers are interested in knowing what the production potential of that is, and we can talk about production potential based on those soil samples. There are a couple of tools out there, web soil surveys and different production explorers, that we can look at production potential, but without seeing those actual soil analysis, it's hard to prophesize what a pasture might do.
Gotcha. Well, you know, as this drought continues, you know, another topic that is definitely going to be of interest to folks is some drought proofing. And I know there's a few things that we can do, not everything, but maybe a few things.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like I had mentioned, the fertilizer, that's always good. Stocking rates are one of the biggest things that I see around here that maybe could use a bit of attention, making for sure that we are adjusting the number of animals per acre based on the forage available, not based on what granddad did or based on, you know, that survey that we saw a long time ago that said 10 acres per cow or whatever. We have to know the size of our animal, how much forage that animal needs to consume to stay in good condition. And then we can actually go and look at what's growing in our pasture and kind of figure out how much grass we have or how much forage we have. It's not always grass. And then match our animals to our pasture. So it's not about a generalization. There is a lot of science and there's a lot of math into a proper stocking rate. And so that is really what is going to drought-proof a pasture. Once you get the fertilization, soil nutrients up to where they need to be, and then maintaining that with our proper stocking rate is really those are the two key factors with that.
So is there a formula out there that you know, you can kind of plug these numbers into and it'll spit out the magic answer?
Yes, there actually is. So we work with animal units. So sometimes when you say a cow, some cows are 1,400 pounds, some cows at full size are 600 pounds. So we work with animal units so we can just kind of make that a simple number. And then we can actually go out and do some forage sampling and figure out how much forage is there based on the height and density of what we're seeing in the pasture. It does take some steps. We've got to get out there and put our shadow in the pastures, but we can use those two factors to figure out how many animals we can support safely.
Gotcha. No, that is definitely some good information, Wendy. And if folks do have maybe questions on how to help figure some of this out, what's the best way to get a hold of you and get some of those resources?
Yeah, give me a call at the Altamont office, 620-784-5337. I'm happy to work with folks on anything pasture management related.
Very good. Well, coming up next segment, of course, we'll be talking with James Coover. And James, what do we have coming up here in just a few?
I'm going to be talking a little bit, continuing on the forage question, and talk a little bit about silage, like what makes good silage, moisture percentages, how to put it up right.
Okay, well, that's on the way here on the Mighty 690. Weather-wise, we are looking at a high right around 80 degrees once again, and we are going to have a mostly sunny one today. Still partly cloudy and 65, and we're dropping down to a low tonight of 63. So we've got our continuing chat with folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District on the way, and we will have a check of the news coming up as well. 65 degrees right now in Coffeyville. Good morning, 8:11 here on the Mighty 690, and we continue our segment with James Coover of K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. How's it going, James?
Doing good.
Hey, we got a little bit of rain. It was really sporadic as far as the amounts.
Yeah, some people got a lot more than others, yeah. But it was all over the place.
Yeah, it really was. Parsons, like a tenth, we got over an inch and a half. Yeah. So, and the airport got, you know, 0.4 of an inch. So just really, really random. So, hey, before we get into our topic here, any crop updates you want to pass along?
No, so far everything looks okay for the amount of rain that we've gotten. I mean, the soybeans, some fields look a lot better than others, depending on how much rain they got, but they're filling out pretty good and they're already starting to dry down, getting the normal yellow coloring. And so everything's carrying along as seen, but we'll see what kind of yields we get when the soybeans get into it. It's really hard to tell with soybeans. It's so much different. So
sure, absolutely. Well, hey, I know you wanted to talk just a little bit about silage today, right?
Yes, and so I'm going to talk a little bit about silage, a little bit about baleage, and so this time of year is when we go around and might see some silage cutters. It's not terribly common in this part of Kansas, but we do have some feedlots, and we do have some, you know, cow-calf operations that like to silage. And so talk a little bit about what that is and what you might be seeing out there. And so generally we think about silage, we think about corn and sorghum silage, But that's not the only stuff that can be salvaged. Really, just about anything, actually. And so, like, let's say you have a wheat field that's filled with weeds. You could silage that. I mean, or you have a field that actually is almost pure weeds. You could technically silage weeds. It's not going to make the best stuff, but you can technically silage weeds. So, what is silage? It's chopping green material up, throwing it in a bag, and the anaerobic process without oxygen is going to ferment that silage and create the acids, break down certain lignin materials, and really preserve and process it. And so it's sort of the same process of when you make beer or vinegar or wine, actually. I mean, it's yeast and other things that are breaking down these sugar components and creating acids and doing some other stuff to it. And it is that process of creating those acids that in alcohols that kind of preserve the material. There's not a whole lot of actual alcohol in silage. There's a little bit. But for the most part, it's the acids that we're looking for when we talk about silage. So that's probably partly why it's best to test before and after you make silage. So the day that they're out there cutting, shortly after that, you need to take a test and see what sort of moisture percentage that you have and sort of what the starting basis of what the silage is going to be. The silage process takes around 3 to 4 weeks, and then it needs to be tested after that. And so the whole processing, you know, all the little microbes doing their little thing, it takes a couple of weeks, and then it needs to be tested again to make sure that everything is correct.
So to get this whole process started, I mean, you got to, like, call the silage people, right?
Yeah. So the vast majority of people around here, it's a custom cutter that comes out. There might be some places in Western Kansas that have their own silage, you know, the feedlots do. But around here, I mean, you only use that stuff like 1-2 days a year. So even the big feedlots around here don't have their own silage stuff. So it's a custom crew that comes, you know, works south to north, and they come and cut, and yeah.
Gotcha. And so the what about like the storage? Obviously we see it, you know, kind of sitting there. Like what is there a time when this stuff's going to like go bad, or like we need to use it by, or how does that work?
So once it's done processing, it actually lasts a long time. And so silage, you don't even technically need to use it the year after you make it. You can really keep onto it for a whole another year. That's not ideal, but it is possible. I mean, if you're not going to use an entire field, right away. And silage makes a lot of stuff. And so corn and sorghum silage, like the really tall sorghum, it could make 15 to 20, sometimes even more wet tons to the acre. And so if you imagine how much, you know, even a small field, a 50-acre field, how much silage you get out of that, it's a lot of stuff. It really is a lot of stuff. And so there's really three different ways of making silage. One, we call it a pit silage, where they just kind of pile it up into a big pile, or usually, you know, it's down low. They've got the hay bales stacked up on the side of it sometimes. But they're packing it in with a tractor or something like that to kind of pack that silage in tight. And they just reasonably assume that it sort of forms a crust on the top, and that's what keeps the oxygen from getting to the rest of it. So, you know, that is a possibility. We don't do a lot of that around here just because you kind of had to have set up for that. Another way of doing it is in those giant long bags that look like giant white worms that, you know, go out there like, you know, Dune, for instance. So that's probably more common here. And really what's in those bags is just chopped up silage. And so this little machine goes along, they pour the silage into it, and it just blows that stuff into the back and really packs it pretty tight. And then the third way is balage. And so balage is where you take the entire bale, like a normal, you know, bale, and you wrap it up. And so you see those, like, those marshmallows, know, around. And so the marshmallows inside of that is what's happening is a normal silage operation.
Okay. Yeah, I saw him putting them in the other day in Labette County. I was like, that's so great.
It is kind of fun to see those. And they do ones where, you know, you have a big, long worm of bales, and they also do ones where they're like individual marshmallow bales too.
Oh, that's great.
And so, you know, but it's the problem with that sometimes is that it's hard to mess with a very wet bale. They're very heavy.
Oh, yeah.
And so, I mean, you take a lot at once. I mean, you got to have the machines to carry that stuff around. And I mean, you could just set those whole silage bales out, but a lot of people like to chop them up too. So if you're dealing with corn or sorghum, it's best to chop the whole thing up. And so, which is why usually when we're talking about silage, it's not baleage. It's something that we've blown in and chopped it up. So for the most part, though, once you get done testing, once the whole process of fermentation is done, you want the pH to be around 5.5. And so it's pretty acidic.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's that acidity that actually helps preserve it. And so it's what keeps the mold out and all the other stuff, which leads next to moisture. So when you're starting the silage process, I mean, we're talking about wet stuff here. So there's a lot of moisture involved. Generally speaking, you want it between 50 to 60% moisture. If it's below 40, you're going to have the issue where not enough acids are being created. You're going to end up with mold problems. And that just kind of spoils the whole thing. And that mold can take over real fast too. And so it's no point in doing it if it's below 40%. If it's above 70%, you can get some seepage out of the bottom of the bag. It kind of makes a wet mess. It's hard to work with a little bit, but also it creates a butyric acid. And that butyric acid, it's just not palatable. So cows don't really like to eat that butyric acid. So if it's too wet, it goes the other direction. It can it'll still silage, but it doesn't make as high quality of silage in there. For the most part, if you cut your silage a little bit late, you're going to be getting to that 60 to 70% area anyway. So you just kind of got to watch it and time it out right with the crop. You can't really, it's hard to dry that stuff down because you're cutting it standing. And so you can technically like windrow the stuff and mix it a little bit. It makes it a lot harder for the silage cutters. And so usually they just want to cut it wet and whatever the moisture is what it is. And so it's really about timing it with the crop just slightly drying down before you want to get into it.
Gotcha. Always a balancing act on all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So obviously this increases the nutrient value, I mean, pretty substantially.
Yes. And so, you know, what really happens is it's mostly actually a preserving process.
Okay.
And so the overall protein increase is not actually all that much higher. Okay. There is a little bit of protein increase, but not too much. And so most silage protein, corn and sorghum silage, is probably around 7 to 8% protein. And that's probably not high enough for some of our cattle. You know, you have a lactating cow. That's not going to be high enough. For some stalkers or other things, you probably need some little protein boosters. So it is a balance. Silage is not a complete protein, just like really anything is, honestly. Everything needs to be balanced. But it is highly digestible. And so cows, I mean, they love it. I mean, it tastes really good. It's fermented food, and they love fermentation. They love acidic foods. And it's also high in energy, too, just because that's what it is. It's corn and sorghum. Or really anything else. And so, I mean, if you're silaging wheat and other weeds, you don't really need to. I mean, it's going to have pretty high protein percentage. So what you're silaging makes a big difference.
Is there anything we should avoid silaging so that it would be a bad idea?
No, actually, you can silage just about anything. You can silage soybeans. I mean, you can silage anything. I mean, most of that stuff you don't want to silage because it's not going to be making as good a quality. But if you have like a failed soybean crop, yeah, you can silage it. One thing, though, if you're silaging something that's not in our grass species, you need to add some sort of inoculation. And so most silage cutters are going to do that anyway. They're going to inoculate doesn't matter what because it's not that hard. It just increases the overall process. But especially if you're going to do soybeans and weeds and other things, broadleaves, you really need to add some sort of inoculation because they don't naturally have that stuff. Also, they don't really have the overall carbohydrates and sugars that other silage do have. So if you are going to silage some sorghum, it is hard to include some sort of grass species in your silage. So what you can do is actually include chopped corn. And so you have some rolled corn, like grain, that you can include into that silage. That will really help. Hmm. Or you can spray it with molasses. And so it sort of sweeten the deal, honestly, when it comes to broadleaf silage. And that will begin the process and it will help begin the process that will take over onto the sorghum or the soybean stuff as well.
That's good to know.
Yeah, there's little tricks that you can do to make
all
that
sorts
all work.
Of stuff.
Yeah, but so me and my dad's place, we're about to start doing our silage. It's not time to do the silage, and so the cutters are either going to come later today or tomorrow. And I mean, we don't have a very big field that we're silaging, but it's going to make a lot of forage, a lot of silage for our small cow-calf operation. So it's something to consider. I mean, when forage is low and you're really kind of looking for something, I mean, of course, you got to plan ahead and all that, but it can make a lot of stuff. So something to keep in mind.
No, that is a great reminder there. Some good options for folks out there, especially as we get into the fall, the busy time of year, and get something like that scheduled. So, James, if anyone has questions for you on this or any crop-related topics, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, so they have questions about silage or ammoniation, which is a whole other process, anaerobic. I mean, it's a process where you got to wrap things. So it looks similar, but it's different. Just give me a call at 620-724-8233.
Okay, very good. Appreciate it, James. And I look forward to chatting again here soon.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right, and we have open line on the way next here on the Mighty 690 KGGF, 66 degrees right now in Coffeyville.